Welcome to the Good Night Sleep Project. On this show, we feature top sleep experts sharing their best tips on sleep apnea, snoring, insomnia, and other sleep issues, and how you can optimize your sleep so you can live a happier and healthier life. And now, let's get started with the show.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Good Night Sleep Project podcast. I have a returning guest, Dr. Jonathan Parker. He's a world-renowned educator on dental sleep medicine, co-founder of the Sleep Performance Institute with Mitchell Howell for 28 years. He served as a faculty member at University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. He's currently an assistant clinical professor at Tufts University School of Dental Medicine. And over the course of his career, he's presented over 200 lectures nationally and internationally on the role of the dentist in the evaluation and treatment of snoring and sleep apnea using oral appliances. And he works with multiple sleep disorder centers in Minneapolis-St. Paul area, known for developing innovative techniques and protocols to, you know, to help patients and get them to sleep better. So at first blush, people may say dentistry and sleep, but I can promise you, listener, that the two are very intimately connected, and thank goodness dentists are waking up to this. So Jonathan, thanks for coming. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
Yeah. Well, for listeners, the first thing we said we'll talk about is athletes and sleep. But just before we get to that, I just want to give listeners an idea. When did dentistry wake up to the fact that they can have an impact on people's sleep? You know, you've been around for a while, so I'm sure you've seen this progression. So can you talk about that?
Sure. So I've been practicing in dental sleep medicine, treating snoring and sleep apnea in my practice for 28 years. And when I started at that time, there were probably somewhere between 12 and 15 dentists who were focused more on treating snoring and sleep apnea in their dental practices. So it's grown dramatically over the last 28 years. And now many more dentists are aware of it, and many more dentists are starting to get involved in treating it. We work with oral devices that hold the jaw. They're like orthodontic retainers, similar, except these devices hold the jaw slightly forward, which opens the airway to help people breathe, to resolve snoring and sleep apnea. So we see a fair number of patients in our practice referred by physicians and sleep medicine physicians for patients who cannot tolerate the CPAP mask. And about 50% of people can't tolerate the CPAP mask for their apnea. So the oral appliances are probably the second most effective therapy for apnea behind the CPAP machines or the mask.
Yeah, and quick question about here. Why do 50% of people not tolerate the CPAP? What is it about it that makes it impossible?
Oh, there are many reasons. CPAP is basically a blower that blows room air through a hose and mask, and the pressure of the air keeps the airway open. So the air is being blown through the nose. So if you have a congested nasal airway, then it's going to be challenging to tolerate it. Some people just can't stand having anything on their face. Some people feel claustrophobic. This mask is connected by a hose to the machine, so some people feel tethered and it's hard to move around, or the mask shifts during the night and the air starts fluttering or blowing out and not keeping the airway open but making a lot of noise. So there are multiple reasons that people can't tolerate it. Another big one is that people wake during the night to use the, you know, to use the restroom, and they come back and they put the mask on and they can't get back to sleep. So there are many different reasons why people struggle using the CPAP, and those are some of them. Some people travel a lot, and, you know, taking a CPAP machine through TSA now is, you know, can be annoying and inconvenient. So people will just leave it at home if they travel for work, and then it's not helping them. So all those reasons and more will influence whether people use their device.
Makes sense. Okay. And then, you know, we can keep going on this track, but we've been down here before. What, yeah. For athletes, let's talk about them for a little bit, because
sure.
You know, everyone looks up to them. And do they, I mean, I know they have therapists, they have chiropractors, they have trainers. And do they now have sleep consultants? Has it gotten to that point for athletes?
Well, it's starting, and you know, it depends on the leagues. My partner, Dr. Mike Howell, has been working with the Minnesota Gopher football team, who had their best year in decades, and he worked with them on scheduling and how improving sleep can maximize their athletic performance. So in college ranks, we see probably maybe 12 to 15 college athletic departments are starting to incorporate sleep. So it's not a huge number considering the number of teams in the NCAA. NBA, well, pretty all, much all the major sports, there are maybe 25 to 30% of the teams that are actively working with sleep health programs to try and optimize athletic performance. So it's starting to grow. The data is extensive on the impact of sleep on athletic performance. And so it's really fascinating for me to see how slowly these sports teams are moving into sleep. They're mainly focusing on training and fitness, obviously, and they're now incorporating nutrition as a piece of it as well. Hydration is another big piece. But the discussion in most athletic programs and on professional sports teams is about rest and restore as opposed to sleep specifically. But the biggest impact for any of these athletes will be improving their quality, the timing, and the length of their sleep. Because if they're able to do that, it makes a dramatic difference in their performance.
So it sounds like the athletes are being told rest and restore, but they're probably not being told what that means.
Yeah,
just a nebulous recommendation.
And I think more than that, the coaching staff is charged with attempting to manage their playing time, their practice time, and so on, in order to try and improve their rest and restore. And they're not really paying close attention to sleep, and that is that's a huge piece of it. So
what would be some specific recommendations for a team in terms of sleep that they're not getting right now?
Well, let's just take, the league with the most difficult schedule and most significant impact on people's lives and their health is the NBA, because they're playing pretty much every other night. They're traveling across time zones and so on. I can give you dozens of examples of injury risk goes up, and if an NBA team plays a back-to-back game, out of town, in other words, away from home, the risk of injury goes up by, I think they said by like 35 to 40%. I mean,
wow,
it's crazy. And you've got athletes who are gamers. They stay, they can stay out late at night. So the bottom line is, in answer to your question, what the research shows is if we're able to extend, and these were studies done at Stanford on the basketball team. They've also done it with the tennis team and the swimming team. But let's take basketball, for example. What they showed with the Stanford basketball team is if they extended sleep by just 60 minutes a night, so 1 hour, they were able to increase speed of the basketball players by 5%, which is huge. They increased their reaction time. They increased split-second decision-making. They improved three-point shooting by 9%. They increased free throw percentage by 9.3%. These are all vital parts of performance in basketball, and they were able to show a dramatic change. So I believe that 70% of rest and restore is healthy sleep. Maybe 15% is dictated by healthy napping, and the other 15% is managing their activity during the daytime, which is what most teams are trying to do right now related to rest.
That's crazy. With those stats, that's all the edge a team would ever need, you know, trounce other teams, and it's all there within their reach, you know, beyond their, I mean, one way, you know, when you're talking about it, I was thinking like, wow, the average basketball team, is that $100 million worth of assets out there playing? I don't even know. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. They're paying these guys millions of dollars, and they want them to perform at their maximum, but they're traveling consistently throughout the year or playing games every other night. And if they're not rested, their performance will be subpar. Not only that, it impacts – I mean, these guys have families, they have friends. It totally shifts the balance in their life and their health. So it's a big deal. There's paying these guys a lot of money, and you want to keep them healthy. So
yeah, no, definitely. Exactly right. Do you think that, owners of teams are aware of this? Or like, how do you let them know the importance? Is this what you lecture about? You know, going.
Well, we've had some discussions with a number of professional sports teams, and some of them pulled the trigger and said yes, and some of them didn't. And I'd say most of them didn't. and it's, you know, they're very cautious about who they expose their athletes to. And, you know, the athletes have their own trainers that they work with, so they're listening to them. So it's, sometimes it's hard to make inroads. But I don't think the owners really understand it. I think the training staff knows about it. Some know more about it than others. So it just depends on the team and the individual trainers or the training staff. Because each team has athletic trainers that work with the athletes to try and get them ready to perform at their best. So those are the people generally that are the decision makers, along with the general managers of the teams.
Do you think if the sports bookies had a line on who slept well last night and who went out, they would make a lot more money?
I don't know. I can tell you the performance would be better. And so here's something interesting. One of the researchers at Stanford was brought into the NBA. They basically looked, I'm trying to remember how they, I think she called them red alert games, where basically she went through the schedule and predicted, not knowing anything about the quality of the teams, and predicted which teams would win based on their schedule and traveling across time zones and so on. And she was 76% right when she made the predictions, just solely based on schedule, sleep, and potential rest for the athletes, forgetting about the quality of the players on the teams.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. So in answer to your question, I mean, I'm extrapolating that to what you're talking about, which is if bookies knew, well, all the bookies need to do is take a look at the schedule, because, you know, this sleep expert was able to look at it and just based on scheduling determine, and whether people were away from home, how many time zones they had to cross, and so on, she was able to calculate pretty accurately which teams had were going to win.
Okay, and then last question or so about athletes. Do they have sleep problems, or are they young, healthy, in shape, and they have no problems?
They're young, healthy, and in shape, but they have significant sleep problems. And I mentioned before that that, you know, if they're up gaming, you know, till 3 or 4 in the morning, they can sleep late to some extent, but they're not really sleeping at the right time for their body. And so just to give you an example, there are 5 critical hormones that are secreted during sleep by our bodies. Melatonin is the first one, which basically balances our circadian rhythm and tells us it's time to sleep. The first half of the night, growth hormone is secreted, and for athletes, it is absolutely critical. It's critical for energy level and endurance and concentration and mood and libido, and it's vital for recovery, and that's what's key in performance, is being able to recover or restore. Then the second half of the night, testosterone is secreted, which also improves energy level and endurance. It growth hormone increases muscle strength and muscle mass in addition to body repair. Testosterone increases concentration and mood. Then the second half of the night, glucose is secreted, which is basically our energy for the next day. And the fifth is sort of early morning when cortisol levels increase, which give us help our immune function and basically keep us rolling during the day. So when you start to when you sleep at the wrong time or have less sleep, you're influencing the balance of all those hormones that are absolutely critical to your health and your performance. So
yeah, this is this brings to mind a question.
Yeah.
Have there been studies done for people that sleep consistently, but they sleep at odd hours? Have they looked at the hormone profile of long-term night owls versus long-term larks, for instance?
Well, if you're sleeping within your rhythm, so it's okay to be a night owl as long as that's your natural rhythm. In other words, if you tried to go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, you couldn't do it. So you lay in bed until 12:30 or 1, and then you can fall asleep. So you can fall asleep. You don't have insomnia, but you need to do it at the right time. And if you do it at the right time, then the sleep cycle and the release of these hormones occurs naturally at the right times. It may be different for, let's take you and your wife. Your cycle may be different than your wife's cycle. So if you're a night owl, you know, your cycle starts at 1 a.m., let's say, and her cycle starts at 10 p.m. because she's more of a lark. And I'm just using this as an example. I have no idea if this is accurate.
You're right. You're pretty much right.
All right. So that means that her cycle with her melatonin secretion is going to start maybe 9 o'clock when it gets dark. Yours is going to start later. So it's going to be harder for you to fall asleep. And then the growth hormone, and once you do fall asleep, growth hormone, then testosterone, then glucose and cortisol will follow in natural rhythm. So in answer to your question, yes, if you're sleeping within your rhythm, then these hormones will function well. So as it relates to this NBA athlete, if his natural level, let's say he has a little circadian delay like you do, well, that would have him going to bed at 1 a.m., which he probably could do because the game ends late and then he has dinner and then, he's got to wind down. But maybe by 1 or 1:30, he could fall asleep. Well, if he's a night owl, that's in his rhythm, So that's why I say, yes, it's possible for them. But if he stays up till 4 a.m., now he's shifted out of his rhythm. And that's where you run into problems because now the hormone secretion's shifted and it's not happening at the right time. And, it makes a difference. Plus our meal times are connected to, when we eat is connected to our circadian rhythm as well. So staying alive, that's important.
Good question. So these hormones, are they triggered? I mean, they're circadian based. So I would think they're triggered by dark light cues. So I noticed for myself, and this is a duh realization, but, if I go to bed late enough, 2 or 3 of my 8 hours of sleep are in daylight outside. Even though I have blackout curtains and all that, I could see that there's enough light in the room to still probably affect me. So unless someone's like super careful and sleeping in pitch darkness and they go to bed late, at least probably 1 or 2 of their hours of sleep will be, outside daylight. Do you think that would affect their hormone cycles and compromise them?
It could. Yes, it could. And that's where sometimes we'll recommend eye masks. If you really truly have blackout curtains, you should be able to keep most of the light out of the room, even if, the sun has come up. I mean, a lot of people run into that in the summertime because the sun comes up early and it goes down later. But if it's coming up early and if it comes up at 5 in the morning and you wake up at 6, you still run into it for that last hour. For night owls, it's going to be more. So having those blackout curtains really black things out is important. Or like I said, an eye mask could be helpful as well if you're comfortable with that.
Okay. And then I'd like to also talk a little bit about couples because I think it was the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. It said like 25% of all couples reported not sleeping together. They may start out that way, but someone snores and, they separate for the night. And I know that means, at least in the beginning, probably one goes to the couch or to an uncomfortable bed and the other one's in the main bed. And you know, who knows the emotions in play and the
right,
the, you know, being upset at the other partner, et cetera. What's your experience there? And then what are some thoughts?
Now, are you talking about snoring or are you talking about sleep timing or what?
But, well, let's talk about both. So let's talk about first snoring.
Okay.
That's probably the most obvious one. You know, husband or the wife snores and the other one can't take it.
Right. Well, and as we've talked about, you know, light, sound, and temperature need to be managed in the bedroom for good sleep. So what we're talking about here is sound or noise. And when somebody snores, it can affect the sleep of others. So during the night, we go through cycles of sleep. And as we move into lighter sleep is when we're going to be bothered most by those noises. And so it can happen trying to fall asleep if the other person's snoring, or when we get into lighter sleep during the night. And in the middle of the night, as you mentioned, there are a lot of emotions that can be generated if your sleep's disrupted by your partner snoring. And so usually they push or try and move the snorer so that they stop snoring for a while and hope they can fall asleep quickly before they start again. So yeah, snoring and apnea can be a big deterrent for people sleeping together. And probably one in four couples sleep in separate rooms for other reasons, but I would say largely it's due to snoring and apnea.
Well, have there been studies that, couples that don't sleep together, does that shorten the average time they'll stay married? Does it lead to marital problems? Any other issues?
Well, I think it certainly causes tension in the marriage. I haven't seen statistics on divorce rates related to, or separation related to, snoring, but clearly it causes tension and people they're looking for solutions. There's no question about it. The snoring market online over the counter is selling, it's hundreds of millions of dollars a year in that industry. The sleep industry is billions of dollars related to beds and all sorts of things, but the snoring industry is hundreds of millions of dollars in sales of products attempting to try and help snoring.
So do you have, let's go back to the oral appliances now. It seems like that's the realm you work in.
Yeah.
Have you seen, like, for instance, in particular with snoring, how good are they? I know it depends on the patient, but how helpful could they be?
Well, the oral appliances, as I mentioned, they hold the jaw forward, which opens the airway, which really eliminates or reduces the noise. And our studies show, and it's research studies that are out there show, around 85%+ of people using the appliances have dramatic improvement in snoring. So they're highly effective in people who snore.
Are they easy to get used to or difficult? Do the appliances allow you to still breathe well, or they fill up your mouth?
Yeah, so the custom-made devices are much thinner and smaller. They fit better, they're more comfortable, and they can be customized to the position that works well for people. So they cost more than the over-the-counter devices, but the over-the-counter devices tend not to last as long and tend not to be as effective. So there's research studies looking at that. So I am always looking at simpler devices, simpler, less costly devices to be able to offer to my patients. But the over-the-counter devices that I've attempted to use have been really bulky and uncomfortable. They've caused more side effects, and they've been less effective. So I continue to work mostly with custom-made devices.
So what's custom about them, and why does that help?
So if somebody came to me who did not have sleep apnea, let's say they only had a snoring problem, and I would say probably 20%+ of people who snore also have apnea. So there's a large percentage of people who do not have sleep apnea, but they snore and cause problems for their bed partners. So for treating just what we call primary snoring with no apnea, what we would do is go through a full assessment and take measurements and a history of what's been happening. And then we would take impressions of the teeth so that we can create a replica of what a person's upper and lower teeth are like so that we can custom make the device to their teeth. And usually these devices fit, they're thin plastic that fit over the upper and lower teeth, and they're usually connected. Either they have wings that are along the side that basically interconnect and hold the jaw slightly forward, or they may have a small screw mechanism on the side that allows us to adjust it so that I would also take a measurement to position the jaw slightly forward to start with. And then the beauty of these devices is they are customizable so that the individual would be able to advance the jaw position slowly until the snoring's gone, and then basically find the sweet spot and be able to sleep quietly with the jaw slightly forward and in a comfortable position. So the process basically of custom making it is we would take or create a replica of the teeth and take a measurement of how we want the jaw positioned, and we would have qualified technicians custom make these devices that fit over the teeth and hold the jaw slightly forward, and then we fit them and adjust them to make sure they're comfortable and effective.
Are people, do they know, I mean, how far forward is forward? So is it just a few millimeters, or is it really exaggeratedly forward? And how do people feel about their jaw in that position for, you know, the whole night?
Yeah, generally people can move their jaw forward quite a bit, and we just move it minimally forward. It's never moved forward more than somebody, they really shouldn't feel much of a strain at all, to be honest. People are actually very surprised that some of them don't even realize their jaw is forward. But also remember that during the night when we relax into sleep, our jaw drops back. With the appliance in, it won't drop back. So we don't have to move it forward too much to make a difference, especially in people who are just snoring.
Well, that's really good. It sounds a lot less invasive, at least to me, than a CPAP. So
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of... you know, again, people not sleeping together, then you mentioned timing. I know that one sleep scientist talked about like a sleep divorce where people don't sleep together deliberately and they seem to be happier. But, you know, when there's a timing issue, when you have a lark and a night owl, what's your recommendations there?
Well, so the question is, because a lot of couples want to sleep together. And what happens many times is that as in the example we used, let's say that in a couple, the wife is more of a lark. She goes to bed earlier, wakes up earlier, and the husband is a night owl. He tends to go to bed later and wake up later, or wants to wake up later. The problem is that they go to bed, let's say at the time that the lark wants to go to bed, that the wife wants to go to bed, let's say is at 10:30, and the night owl, the husband, goes to bed and they talk a little bit, and then she goes to sleep and he lies there and he can't fall asleep. So usually he thinks he's got insomnia, so he may start taking pills to try and help him sleep. But the reality is that he can't sleep. He can sleep, but he can't sleep at that time. It's too early for his natural rhythm. So then the question is, if they want to sleep together, how do you now start to condense their rhythms so that they're more consistent? Well, the first thing that we recommend, let's say for the husband, is that he needs to get bright light in the morning immediately after waking. And so if he can go out for a walk, if it's in the summertime, and he can go out for a walk for 30 minutes in the bright sunshine without sunglasses on, that will start to trigger his circadian rhythm. Or if he can't get outside, let's say he's in the northern part of the U.S., especially in the wintertime, there is no sunshine earlier in the morning. So then you could buy a light box, and I can certainly give you manufacturers' names if that's okay, but buy a 10,000 lux light box, and it just needs to be, it needs to hit your retina. So it doesn't have to be directly in front of you, but, you know, 60 degrees on either side. And you need 30 to 60 minutes in the morning while you're doing other things. If you're in the bathroom, if you're having breakfast, just have the light box there to make sure that you're getting bright light in the morning for at least 30 minutes. And you want to do it right away if you can. Once you trigger
that'll, that'll set your clock.
So that'll start to reset your clock.
Okay.
So it tells your body, hey, there's bright light here in the morning. And that means that later in the day, hopefully closer to 10 o'clock or so, instead of midnight or 1, your melatonin will start to kick in so that you will be tired enough to go to sleep earlier. So you do that for a week or so, and if you're finding that it's helping a little but not much, then you can add melatonin in the evening. And if you, let's say you want to go to bed at 1, let's say you naturally go to bed at 1:30, but you want to go to bed at 10:30 p.m., then you'd probably start taking the melatonin about 3 to 4 hours before bedtime, which would be, if you go to bed at 1:30, then it would mean taking it about 9:30 or 10 o'clock.
And so that far in advance of sleep? I thought it would be like an hour before.
No, not well. You're trying to back it. She goes to bed at 10:30. You want to back up your sleep time closer to 10:30. Initially, I would start about 3 to 4 hours ahead.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Okay.
And then after a week, I would do it an hour later. So instead of at 10 o'clock, you do it at 11 o'clock. Okay. And so now what you want to do is you want to start seeing if you're ready to sleep. You know, you may go instead of at 1:30, you feel sleepy at 1 o'clock, then maybe 12:30, then maybe midnight. I think it start after, within a month, you should really be closer to 11:30 instead of 1:30. If you follow this, taking the melatonin 3 to 4 hours ahead initially, because you're trying to, you know, you're trying to move it back at least 3 hours. And then after a week, you move it closer by an hour and then closer by an hour. I mean, then you'll be at 1 hour before bedtime.
If you take melatonin, how long before you start to feel really tired?
Depends. It depends on what your natural rhythm was. It's not dose dependent, so you only need about a milligram. So well, people are taking 5 milligrams. They don't need 5 milligrams. 1 milligram is plenty.
Oh, yeah. What happens if you take 5 or 10? And you what happens if you take it and you take it for an extended period of time? What would have been?
Well, right now, the studies don't seem to indicate that there are any major side effects, but it's a hormone. So you really should only take what you need. I think at this point, we don't know what the long-term implications are, but at this, we don't really have any data that shows any potential risk.
All right, well, that's good at least. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, if people are sleeping better, they're going to be much more intimate as well. And so, I mean, everything, relationships get better. They're kinder. Sex is better. They're more willing and interested. There was a study done at the University of Michigan that for every extra hour of sleep a woman receives, it made her 14% more likely to engage in partnered sexual activity. So, you know, that there are a lot of pieces to the improvement in sleep and sleep timing that will benefit a relationship.
Well, very good. What last question or so, what are some of the problems people can have where they may not realize that they're either having apnea or snoring or their sleep's being affected? They think it's something else for some reason, but that's the real reason, and they should consider maybe getting a sleep study.
Well, anybody who snores and has high blood pressure should have a sleep test done. Snoring with, you know, if there are intermittent pauses in breathing, definitely should have a sleep study done. So any health problems, diabetes and snoring, they're all correlated or connected with apnea. So for sure, if somebody has any health issues and they snore, they should talk to their physician about it. And I think that they should have a sleep study done. Anybody who's heavier, more obese, Age, weight, anatomy, and hormones are the four probably strongest factors influencing sleep apnea or the presence of sleep apnea. So those are things that if you have any of those, or if you're sleepy during the day, you know, you wake up and you just don't feel rested, or you feel like you're dragging during the day. Most people with sleep apnea don't know they have it because they're sleeping. So these are some of the signs and symptoms that would indicate that they may have sleep apnea and they should have it evaluated.
Well, very good. And then people that are local to you, what is local and how can they, you know, check out your clinics?
So I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and our clinic is the Snoring and Sleep Apnea Dental Treatment Center. We're in a suburb of Minneapolis and also a suburb of St. Paul. And our practice is limited to snoring and sleep apnea. That's all we do, and work with sleep issues. And then the Sleep Performance Institute works with corporations and with athletes to try and improve sleep health and performance, which also improves relationships in the workplace and improves, you know, work function. So those are the two companies that I'm involved with, and they do separate things, but all related to sleep.
Well, very good. Jonathan, thank you for coming on the podcast. And, it's, you know, it's always great to have you. You get a lot of knowledge. It's been good. Time number two.
Great. Thank you for having me, and be well.
Thanks for listening to the Good Night Sleep Project podcast. Subscribe and share the show today. Go to goodnightsleepproject.com. Remember, if you have a health issue, contact your healthcare provider. No doctor-patient relationship is formed by listening. This show is informational only, and no medical advice is being given, and not a replacement for medical care.